Welcome to yet another bonus episode of Never To Be Seen Again, the podcast. So I told you in the Texas episode that this bonus episode was coming, but I didn't tell you what it was going to be about. This is kind of an extension of the first Texas bonus episode, so we can call this Texas Lanyap episode 2. So what I'm going to tell you about here is something that I came across while I was doing research for the first Texas bonus episode. In that first episode, I told you about Texas does. Well, this is another doe case, but it's a lot more than that. It's a pretty big and interesting story, which is why I just decided to make another bonus episode to tell you about it. I'm pretty excited about this, though, because I get to tell you about another serial killer. Now, I'm sure most of you have heard about this person, and that's okay. If you don't want to hear it again, you can opt to skip over this episode, or you can just stay around and listen. I'm not really here to tell you this story because I want you to know about the serial killer. I want you to know about the doe in this case. So here we go with the story of the serial killer known as the Candyman, Dean Corll, and his yet-to-be-identified victim. Most of what I'm going to tell you comes straight from the Wikipedia page, and some of the details in this case are graphic, so I will say that listener discretion is advised. So, Dean Arnold Corll was born on December 24th, so Christmas Eve, of 1939 in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He was the first child born to Mary Emma Robinson and Arnold Edwin Corll. Corll's father was a very strict father, whereas his mother was markedly protective of both of her sons. Their marriage was sometimes a difficult one, and they quarreled frequently. But eventually, the couple divorced in 1946, 4 years after the birth of their youngest son, Stanley Wayne Corll. Mary Corll subsequently sold the family home and relocated to a trailer home in Memphis, Tennessee, where Arnold Corll had been drafted into the U.S. Air Force after the divorce. She moved there so that both of her sons could remain in contact with their father. So Dean was a shy, serious child who seldom socialized with other children, but at the same time, he displayed concern for the well-being of others. At the age of 7, he suffered an undiagnosed case of rheumatic fever, which was not recognized until doctors found Corll had a heart murmur in 1950. And as a result of that diagnosis, Dean was ordered to avoid physical education at school. So Dean's parents attempted a reconciliation and remarried again in 1950. And they subsequently moved to Pasadena, Texas. However, the reconciliation was short-lived, and in 1953, the couple once again divorced, with their mom once again retaining custody of the two boys. Their divorce was granted on amicable grounds, and both boys really maintained a regular relationship with their father. So following the second divorce, Mary Corll, or Dean's mom, remarried a traveling clock salesman named Jake West. The family moved to the small town of Vidor, Texas, where Corll's half-sister Joyce was born in 1955. So upon advice from a pecan salesman, Corll's mother and stepfather started a small family candy company named Pecan Prince, and it was initially operated from the garage of their home. From the earliest days of the candy business, Dean Corll worked day and night while still attending school, and he and his younger brother were delegated the responsibility of running the candy making machine and packing the product, which his stepfather sold on his sales route. This route often involved Wes traveling to Houston, where much of his product was sold. So from 1954 to 1958, Dean attended Vider High School, where he was regarded as a well-behaved student who achieved satisfactory grades. As had been the case in his childhood, Dean also was considered somewhat of a loner, although he is known to have occasionally dated girls in his teenage years. In high school, Dean's only major interest was the brass band, and he played the trombone in the band. So after Dean graduated from Vider High School in the summer of 1958, shortly after that, he and his family moved to the northern outskirts of Houston so that the family candy business could be closer to the city where the majority of their product was sold. So Dean's family opened a new shop, which they named Pecan Prince in reference to the brand name of the family product. In 1960, at the request of his mother, Dean moved to Indiana to live with his widowed grandmother. During this period of time, Dean formed a close relationship with a local girl, although he rejected a subsequent marriage proposal she made to him in 1962. Dean lived in Indiana for almost 2 years, but returned to Houston in 1962 to help with his family's candy business, which by this date had moved to Houston Heights. He later moved into an apartment of his own above the candy shop. So Dean's mother divorced Jake West in 1963 and opened a new candy business, which she named Coral Candy Company. Her eldest son was appointed vice president of the new firm, with the younger brother, Stanley, being appointed secretary treasurer. The same year, one of the teenage male employees of Coral Candy Company complained to Coral's mother that Coral had made sexual advances towards him, and in response, Mary West fired the teenager who made the complaint. So, Dean was drafted into the United States Army on August 10th of 1964, and he was assigned to Fort Polk, Louisiana for basic training. He was later assigned to Fort Benning, Georgia to train as a radio repairman before his permanent assignment in Fort Hood, Texas. According to official military records, Dean's period of service in the Army was unblemished. Dean, however, reportedly hated military service, and he applied for a hardship discharge on the grounds that he was needed in the family's business. The Army granted his request, and he was given an honorable discharge on June 11th of 1965, after only 10 months of service. Reportedly, Dean divulged to some of his close acquaintances after his release from the Army that it was during his period of service that he had first realized that he was homosexual and had experienced his first homosexual encounter. Other acquaintances noted subtle changes in Dean's mannerisms in the company of teenage males after he had completed his service in the Army and returned to Houston, which led to them to believe that he may have been homosexual. So he went into the Army, realized he was homosexual. When he got out, he was hanging out with young kids and young boys. And I guess a lot of people noticed that and concluded that he might be gay. So following his honorable discharge from the Army, Dean returned to Houston Heights and resumed the position he had once held as vice president of his family candy business. Dean's former stepfather had retained ownership of the family's former candy business following his mother's divorce in 1963, and the competition between the two firms was pretty fierce. As had been the case in his teenage years, Dean increased the number of hours he devoted to the candy business to satisfy an increasing public demand for his family's product. In 1965, the Coral Candy Company relocated to 22nd Street, directly across the street from Helms Elementary School. Dean was known to give free candy to local children, in particular teenage boys. As a result of this behavior, he earned himself the nickname the Candy Man and the Pied Piper. The company employed a small workforce, and he was seen to behave flirtatiously towards several teenage male employees. Dean is known to have installed a pool table at the rear of the candy factory where employees and local youth would congregate. So it kind of seems like we're setting up a pattern here. In 1967, Dean befriended a 12-year-old boy by the name of David Owen Brooks. He was then a sixth grade student and one of the many children whom Dean had given free candy to. Brooks initially became one of Dean's many youthful close companions, regularly socializing with Dean and various teenage boys who congregated at the rear of the candy company to shoot pool or whatever. He also joined Dean on the regular trips he took to South Texas beaches in the company of various youths, and later commented that Dean was the first adult male who did not mock his appearance. Whenever Brooks told Dean he needed cash, Dean gave him money, and the youth began to view Dean as a father figure. Upon Dean's urging, a sexual relationship gradually developed between the two. Beginning in 1969, Dean paid Brooks in cash or with gifts to allow him to perform oral sex on the youth. Brooks' parents were divorced, his father lived in Houston, and his mother had relocated to Beaumont, a city 85 miles east of Houston. In 1970, when he was 15, Brooks dropped out of Waltrip High School and moved to Beaumont to live with his mother. Whenever he visited his father in Houston, he also visited Dean, who allowed him to stay at his apartment if he wanted to. Later the same year, Brooks moved back to Houston. By his own later admission, Brooks began regarding Dean's apartment as his second home. By the time Brooks dropped out of high school, Dean's mother and Joyce, his half-sister, had moved to Colorado after the failure of her third marriage and the closure of the family candy company in June of 1968. Although she often talked to her oldest son on the phone, his mother never saw him again after that point. So once she moved to Colorado, that was kind of the end of their relationship as far as in person. So following the closure of the candy company, Dean took a job as an electrician at the Houston Lighting and Power Company, where he tested electrical relay systems. He worked in this employment until the day he died, essentially. Between 1970 and 1973, Dean is known to have killed a minimum of 28 victims. All of his victims were males aged 13 to 20, the majority of whom were in their mid-teens. Most victims were abducted from Houston Heights, which was then a low-income neighborhood northwest of downtown Houston. With most abductions, he was assisted by one or both of his teenage accomplices, Elmer Wayne Henley and David Owen Brooks. Now, I haven't mentioned Henley before. Several victims were friends of either or both of Coral's accomplices, or Dean's accomplices. Others were individuals with whom Dean had himself become acquainted prior to their abduction and murder. And two other victims, Billy Balch and Gregory Winkle, were former employees of the Coral Candy Company. Dean's victims were usually lured into either one of the two vehicles he owned, a Ford Ecoline van and a Plymouth GTX, or a 1969 Chevy Corvette. He is known to have purchased for David Brooks in early 1971. The enticement was typically an offer of party or a lift, and the victim would be driven to his house. So at Dean's house, the youth would be plied with alcohol or other drugs until they passed out, tricked into donning handcuffs, or simply grabbed by force. They were then stripped naked and tied to either Dean's bed or usually a plywood torture board, which was regularly hung on the wall. Once they were restrained, the victims would be sexually assaulted, beaten, tortured, and sometimes, after several days, killed by strangulation or shooting with a .22 caliber pistol. Their bodies were then tied in plastic sheeting and buried in one of four places: a rented boat shed, a beach on the Boulevard Peninsula, a woodland near Lake Sam Rayburn, Dean's family owned a lakeside log cabin there, that's why he chose that place, or they would be buried on a beach in Jefferson County. I'm sorry. In several instances, Dean forced his victims to either phone or write to their parents with explanations for their absence in an effort to allay the parents' fears for their son's safety. Dean is also known to have retained keepsakes, usually keys, from his victims. During the years in which he abducted and murdered his victims, Dean often changed addresses. However, until he moved to Pasadena in the spring of 1973, he always lived in or close to Houston Heights. So, Dean killed his first known victim, an 18-year-old college freshman, Jeffrey Conan, on September 25th of 1970. Conan vanished while hitchhiking with another student from the University of Texas to his parents' home in Houston. He was dropped off alone at the corner of Westheimer Road and South Voss Road near the uptown area of Houston. Dean likely offered Conan a lift to his parents' home, which Conan evidently accepted. At the time of Conan's disappearance, Dean lived in an apartment on Yorktown Street near its intersection with Westheimer Road. David Brooks led police to the body of Jeffrey Conan on August 10th of 1973. The body was buried at High Island Beach. Forensic scientists subsequently deduced that the youth had died of asphyxiation caused by manual strangulation, and a cloth gag had been placed in his mouth. The body was found buried beneath a large boulder, covered with a layer of lime, wrapped in plastic, naked, and bound hands and feet suggest that he had been violated. About the time of Conan's murder, David Brooks interrupted Dean in the act of sexually assaulting two teenage boys whom he had strapped to a four-poster bed. Dean promised Brooks a new car in return for his silence, and Brooks accepted the offer, and Dean later bought him a green Chevy Corvette. Dean later told Brooks that he had killed the two boys and offered him $200 for any boy that he could lure to Dean's apartment. So now he's making a deal with this young boy who he had sexually violated to he's offering him $200 a head for a youth that he could essentially rape, torture, and kill. So on December 13th of 1970, Brooks lured two 14-year-old Spring Branch youths named James Glass and Danny Yates away from a religious rally held in the Heights District of Houston to Coral's Yorktown apartment. Glass was an acquaintance of Brooks who, at Brooks' behest, had previously visited Dean's apartment. Both youths were tied to opposite sides of Dean's torture board and subsequently raped, strangled, and buried in a boat shed he had rented on November 17th. So, about a month before. 6 weeks after the double murder of Glass and Yates on January 30th of 1971, Brooks and Dean encountered two teenage brothers, Donald and Jerry Waldrop, walking towards their parents' home. The Waldrop brothers had been driven to a friend's home by their father with plans to discuss forming a bowling league and had begun walking home after learning their friend was not home. Both boys were enticed into Dean's van and driven to an apartment Dean had rented on Mangum Road, where they were raped, tortured, strangled, and subsequently buried in the boat shed. Between March and May of 1971, Dean abducted and killed three victims, all of whom lived in Houston Heights and all of whom were buried towards the rear of the rented boat shed. In each of these abductions, Brooks is known to have been a participant. One of these three victims, 15-year-old Randall Harvey, was last seen by his family on the afternoon of March 9th, cycling towards Oak Forest, where he worked part-time as a gas station attendant. Harvey was driven to Dean's Mangum Road apartment, where he was subsequently killed by a single gunshot to the head. The other two victims, 13-year-old David Hillegast and 16-year-old Gregory Winkle, were abducted and killed together on the afternoon of May 29, 1971. As had been the case with parents of other victims of Dean, both sets of parents launched frantic searches for their sons. One of the youths who voluntarily offered to distribute posters the parents had printed that offered a reward for information leading to the boys' whereabouts was 15-year-old Elmer Wayne Henley, a lifelong friend of Hillegast, so one of the boys that went missing. The youth pinned the reward poster around the Heights and attempted to reassure Hillegast's parents that there may be an innocent explanation for the boys' absence. On August 17th of 1971, Dean and Brooks encountered a 17-year-old acquaintance of Brooks named Reuben Watson Haney walking home from a movie theater in Houston. Brooks persuaded Haney to attend a party at an address Dean had moved to on San Felipe Street the previous month. Haney agreed and was taken to Dean's home, where he was subsequently strangled and buried in the boat shed. So now the bodies are really kind of stacking up here. In September of 1971, Dean moved to another apartment in the Heights. Brooks later stated he had assisted Dean in the abduction and murder of two youths during the time Dean resided at this address, including one youth who was killed just before Wayne Henley came into the picture. In his confession, Brooks stated the youth killed immediately prior to Henley's involvement in the murders was abducted from the Heights and kept alive for approximately 4 days before his murder. The identity of both of these victims remains unknown. Well, that's not really true anymore, but I'll explain that later. In the winter of 1971, Brooks introduced Elmer Wayne Henley to Dean Cole. Henley likely was lured to Dean's address as an intended victim. So Elmer Wayne Henley, if you don't remember that name, he was the friend of one of the missing boys who was hanging up the posters. So anyway, he was lured to Dean's apartment as an intended victim. However, Dean evidently decided that the youth would make a good accomplice and offered him the same $200 fee for any boy he could lure to his apartment. And he informed Henley that he was involved in a white slavery ring operation from Dallas. Henley later stated that for several months he ignored Dean's offer. However, in early 1972, he decided to accept the offer because he and his family were in dire financial circumstances. Henley said the first abduction he participated in occurred during the time Dean resided at 925 Schuller Street, an address Dean moved to in February of 1972. Brooks later claimed that Henley became involved in the abductions while Dean resided at the address he had occupied immediately prior to Schuller Street. If Henley's statement is to be believed, the victim was abducted from the Heights in February or early March of 1972. In the statement Henley gave to the police following his arrest, the youth stated he and Dean picked up a boy at the corner of 11th and Studewood and lured him to Dean's home on the promise of smoking some weed with them. At Dean's house, using a ruse he and Dean had prepared, Henley cuffed his own hands behind his back, freed himself with a key hidden in his back pocket, then duped the youth into donning the handcuffs before observing Dean bind and gag him. Henley then left the youth alone with Dean, believing he was to be sold into the sexual slavery ring. The identity of this victim is not conclusively known, although it is possible the youth was Willard Braunch, a 17-year-old Oak Forest youth known to both Coral and Henley, who disappeared on February 9th of 1972, and whose emasculated body was found buried in the boat shed. A month later, on March 24th of 1972, Henley, Brooks, and Dean encountered an 18-year-old acquaintance of Henley's named Frank Aguirre, leaving a restaurant on Yale Street where the youth worked. Henley called him over to Dean's van and invited him to drink beer and smoke weed with the trio at Dean's apartment. The boy agreed and followed the trio to Dean's home in his Rambler. That's the car he was driving at the time. Inside Dean's home, the boy smoked marijuana with the group before picking up a pair of handcuffs Dean had left on his table. In response, Dean pounced on this boy, pushing him onto the table and cuffing his hands behind his back. Henley later claimed that he had not known of Dean's true intentions towards this boy when he had persuaded the boy to accompany him to Dean's house. In a 2010 interview, he claimed to have attempted to persuade Dean not to assault and kill this boy once Dean and Brooks had bound and gagged him. However, Dean refused, informing Henley that he had raped, tortured, and killed the previous victims he had assisted in abducting, and that he intended to do the same thing with this one. Henley subsequently assisted Dean and Brooks in Aguirre's burial at Heights Island Beach. Despite the revelations that Dean was in reality killing the boys he and Brooks had assisted in abducting, Henley nonetheless became an active participant in the abduction and murders. Within 1 month, on April 20th, 1972, he assisted Dean and Brooks in the abduction of another boy, a 17-year-old named Mark Scott. Scott, who was well known to both Henley and Brooks, was grabbed by force and fought furiously against attempts by Dean to restrain him, even attempting to stab his attacker with a knife. However, Scott saw Henley pointing a pistol towards him, and according to Brooks, Scott just gave up. Scott was tied to the torture board and suffered the same fate as Aguirre: raped, tortured, strangled, and buried at Height Island Beach. Brooks stated Henley was especially sadistic in his participation in the murders committed at Schuyler Street. Before Dean vacated the address on June 26th, Henley assisted Dean and Brooks in the abduction and murder of two boys named Billy Bulch and Johnny DeLome. In Brooks' confusion, he stated that both boys were tied to Dean's bed, and after their torture and rape, Henley manually strangled Bulch, then shouted, "Hey, Johnny," and shot DeLome in the forehead with the bullet exiting through the boy's ear. DeLome then pleaded with Henley, "Wayne, please don't," before he was strangled. Both boys were buried at Height Island Beach. During the time Dean resided at Schuyler Street, the trio lured a 19-year-old named Billy Ridinger to the house. Ridinger was tied to the plywood board, tortured and abused by Dean. Brooks later claimed he persuaded Dean to allow Ridinger to be released, and the boy was allowed to leave the residence. On another occasion, during the time Dean resided on Schuyler Street, Henley knocked Brooks unconscious as he entered the house. Dean then tied Brooks to his bed and assaulted him repeatedly before releasing him. Despite this assault, Brooks continued to assist Dean in the abduction of victims. I don't know what is going on here. Why these two boys are so willing. I don't know. I guess it's a different time. So after vacating the Schuyler residence, Dean moved to an apartment on Westcott Towers, where in the summer of 1972, he is known to have killed a further two victims. The first of these victims, 17-year-old Stephen Sickman, was last seen leaving a party held in the Heights shortly before midnight on July 19th. The boy was savagely bludgeoned about the chest with a blunt instrument before he was strangled and buried in the boat shed. Approximately 1 month later, on or about August 21st, a 19-year-old named Roy Bunton was abducted while walking to his job as an assistant in a Houston shoe store. Bunton was shot twice in the head and was buried in the boat shed. Neither of the boys was named by either Brooks or Henley as being a victim of Dean, and both boys were only identified as victims in 2011. So these two boys were killed during this period of time, but they didn't initially know about him, apparently. On October 7th of 1972, Henley and Brooks encountered two Heights boys, Wally J. Simoneau and Richard Hembry. Hanley and Brooks spotted the boys walking to Hembree's home. Samino and Hembree entered, they were enticed into Brooks's Corvette and driven to Dean's Westcott Towers apartment. That evening, Samino is known to have phoned his mother's home and to have shouted the words "Mama" into the receiver before the connection was terminated. The following morning, Hembree was accidentally shot in the mouth by Hanley. Several hours later, both youths were strangled to death and subsequently buried in a common grave inside Dean's boat shed directly above the bodies of James Glass and Danny Yates. The following month, a 19-year-old Heights youth named Richard Kapner disappeared on his way to a phone booth. Kapner was strangled and buried at High Island Beach. Altogether, a minimum of 10 teenagers between the ages of 13 and 19 were murdered between February and November of 1972, five of whom were buried at High Island Beach and five inside Dean's boat shed. On January 20th of 1973, Dean moved to an address on Wirt Road in the Spring Branch District of Houston. Within 2 weeks of moving into this address, he had killed 17-year-old Joseph Lyles. Lyles was known to both Dean and Brooks. He had lived on Antoine Drive, the same street upon which Brooks resided in 1973. On March 7th, Dean vacated his Wirt Road apartment and moved to 2020 Lamar Drive, an address his father had vacated in Pasadena. So 2020 Lamar Drive is going to be a whole thing in and of itself. So no known victims were killed between February 1st and June 4th of 1973. Dean is known to have suffered from hydrocel in early 1973, which may have contributed to his period of inactivity. In addition, around the time of Lyle's murder, Hanley had temporarily moved away from Houston to Mount Pleasant in an apparent effort to distance himself from Dean. These facts may have accounted for the sudden lull in killing. Nonetheless, from June, Dean's rate of killing increased dramatically, and both Hanley and Brooks later testified to the increase in the level of brutality of the murders committed while Dean resided at Lamar Drive. Hanley later compared the acceleration in the frequency of killing and the increase in the brutality exhibited by Dean towards his victims to being like a bloodlust, adding that he and Brooks would instinctively know when Dean was to announce that he needed to do a new boy due to the fact that he would appear restless, smoking cigarettes, and making reflex movements. On June 4th, Hanley and Dean abducted 15-year-old William Ray Lawrence. This boy was last seen alive by his father on 31st Street. After 3 days of abuse and torture, Lawrence was strangled before being buried at Lake Sam Rayburn. Less than 2 weeks later, 20-year-old Raymond Stanley Blackburn was abducted, strangled, and buried at Lake Sam Rayburn. On July 6, 1973, Wayne Hanley began attending classes at the coach's driving school in Bel Air, where he became acquainted with 15-year-old Homer Lewis Garcia. The following day, Garcia phoned his mother to say he was spending the night with a friend. He was shot and left to bleed to death in Dean's bathtub before he was buried at Lake Sam Rayburn. 5 days later, on June 12th, 17-year-old John Sellers of Orange County was bound, shot to death, and buried at High Island Beach. In June, 1973, David Brooks married his pregnant fiancee, and Henley temporarily became Dean's sole procurer of victims, assisting in the abduction and murder of three Heights boys between July 19th and July 25th. Henley claimed that these three abductions were the only three that occurred after his becoming an accomplice to Dean, in which David Brooks was not a participant. One of these three victims, 15-year-old Michael Bulch, brother of previous victim Billy Bulch, was last seen by his family on July 19th on his way to get a haircut. He was strangled and buried at Lake Sam Rayburn. The other two victims, Charles Coble and Marty Ray Jones, were abducted together on the afternoon of July 25th. Henley himself later buried both boys' bodies in the boat shed. On August 3rd, 1973, Dean killed his last victim, a 13-year-old boy from South Houston named James Stanton Dremela. Dremela was abducted by Brooks and Dean while riding his bike in Pasadena and driven to Lamar Drive upon the pretense of collecting empty glass bottles to resell. At Dean's home, this boy was tied to Dean's torture board, raped, tortured, and strangled with a cord before being buried in the boat shed. David Brooks later described Dremela as a small, blonde boy for whom he had bought a pizza and in whose company he had spent 45 minutes before the boy was attacked. I know this is a lot, but don't worry, we're coming to an end here. On the evening of August 7th, 1973, Henley, who is now age 17, invited a 19-year-old named Timothy Cordell Curley to attend a party at Dean's Pasadena residence. Curley, a casual acquaintance of Dean, who was intended to be his next victim, accepted the offer. David Brooks was not present at the time. The two boys arrived at Dean's house, where they sniffed paint fumes and drank alcohol until midnight before leaving the house to purchase sandwiches. Henley and Curley then drove back to Houston Heights, and Curley parked his vehicle close to Henley's home. Henley exited the vehicle and walked towards the home of 15-year-old Rhonda Louise Williams, a friend of his, who had been beaten by her drunken father that evening and who had decided to temporarily leave home until her father became sober. Henley invited Williams to spend the evening at Dean's home. Williams agreed and climbed into the back seat of Curley's Volkswagen. The trio then drove towards Dean's Pasadena residence. At approximately 3 a.m. on the morning of August 8th, 1973, Henley and Curley, accompanied by Williams, returned to Dean's residence. Dean was furious that Henley had brought a girl to his house, telling him in private that he had ruined everything. Henley explained that Williams had argued with her father that evening and did not wish to return home. Dean appeared to calm down and offered the trio beer and marijuana. The three teenagers began drinking and smoking weed with Henley, and Henley and Curley were also sniffing paint fumes as Dean watched them intently, like a real creeper. After approximately 2 hours, Henley, Curley, and Williams each passed out. Henley awoke to find himself laying upon his stomach and Dean snapping handcuffs around his wrists. His mouth had been taped shut and his ankles had been bound together. Curley and Williams lay beside Henley, securely bound with nylon rope, gagged with adhesive tape, and laying face down on the floor. Curley had been stripped naked. Noting Henley had awoken, Dean removed the gag from his mouth. Henley protested in vain against Dean's actions, whereupon Dean reiterated that he was angry with Henley for bringing a girl to his house and that he was going to kill all three teenagers after he had assaulted and tortured Curly, initially stating, "Man, you blew it bringing that girl," before shouting, "I'm going to kill you all, but first I'm going to have my fun." He then repeatedly kicked Williams in the chest before dragging Henley into his kitchen and placing a .22 caliber pistol against his stomach, threatening to shoot him. Henley calmed down, Dean promising to participate in the torture and murder of both Williams and Curly if Dean released him. Dean agreed and untied Henley, then carried Curly and Williams into the bedroom and tied them to opposite sides of the torture board, Curly on his stomach, Williams on her back. Dean then handed Henley a hunting knife and ordered him to cut away Williams' clothes, insisting that while he would rape and kill Curly, Henley would do likewise with Williams. Henley began cutting away Williams' clothes as Dean undressed and began to assault and torture Curly. Both Curly and Williams had awakened by this point. Curly began writhing and shouting as Williams, whose gag Henley had removed, lifted her head and asked Henley, "Is this for real?" To which Henley answered, "Yes." Williams then asked Henley, "Are you going to do anything about it?" Henley then asked Dean whether he might take Williams to another room. Dean ignored him, and Henley then grabbed Dean's pistol, shouting, "You've gone far enough, Dean." As Dean clambered off Curly, Henley elaborated, "I can't go on any longer. I can't have you kill all my friends." Dean approached Henley, saying, "Kill me, Wayne." Henley stepped back a few paces as Dean continued to advance upon him, shouting, "You won't do it." Henley then fired at Dean, hitting him in the forehead. The bullet failed to fully penetrate Dean's skull, and he continued to lurch towards Henley, whereupon the youth fired another two rounds, hitting Dean in the left shoulder. Dean then ran out of the room, hitting the wall of the hallway. Henley fired three additional bullets into the lower back and shoulder as Dean slid down the wall in the hallway outside the room where the two other teenagers were bound. Dean died where he fell, his naked body lying face down, face towards the wall. Henley would later recall that having shot Dean, the sole thought in his mind in the moments immediately thereafter was that Dean would have been proud of the way he had reacted to confrontation, adding that Dean had been training him to react fast and react greatly, and that was what he had done. After he had shot Dean, Henley released Curly and Williams from the torture board, and all three teenagers dressed and discussed what actions they should take. Henley suggested to Curly and Williams that they would simply leave, to which Curly replied, "No, we should call the police." Henley agreed and looked up the number for the Pasadena police in Coral's telephone directory. At 8:24 a.m. on August 8th of 1973, Henley placed a call to the Pasadena police. His call was answered by an operator named Velma Lines. In his call, Henley blurted to the operator, "Y'all better come here right now. I just killed a man." Henley gave the address to the operator as 2020 Lamar Drive, Pasadena. As Curly, Williams, and Henley waited upon Dean's porch for the police to arrive, Henley mentioned to Curly that he had done that, killed by shooting, 4 or 5 times. Minutes later, a Pasadena police car arrived at 2020 Lamar Drive. The three teenagers were sitting on the porch outside of the house, and the officers noted the .22 caliber pistol on the driveway near the trio. Henley told the officer that he was the individual who had made the call and indicated that the body of Dean Corll was inside the house. After confiscating the pistol and placing Henley Williams and Curly inside the patrol car, the officer entered the bungalow and discovered Dean's body inside the hallway. The officer returned to the car and read Henley his Miranda rights. In response, Henley shouted, "I don't care who knows about it. I have to get it off my chest." Curly later told detectives that before the police officers had arrived at Lamar Drive, Henley had informed him, "If you weren't my friend, I could have gotten $200 for you." So, in custody at the Pasadena Police Department, Henley initially was questioned in relation to the killing of Dean Corll. He recounted the events of the previous evening and that very morning, explaining that he had shot Dean in self-defense. The statement given by Curly and Williams corroborated Henley's account, and the detectives questioning Henley believed he had indeed acted in self-defense. When questioned regarding his claims that Dean had threatened him that morning, he had shouted that he had killed several boys. Henley explained that for almost 3 years, he and David Brooks had helped procure teenage boys, some of whom had been their own friends for Dean, who had raped and murdered them. Henley gave a verbal statement stating he initially had believed the boys he had abducted were to be sold into a Dallas-based organization for homosexual acts, sodomy, maybe later killing, but soon learned that Dean was himself killing the victims that he had procured. Henley admitted he had assisted Dean in several abductions and murders, and that he had actively participated in the torture and mutilation of 6 or 8 victims prior to their murder. Most victims had been buried in a Southwest Houston boat shed, with others buried at Lake Sam Rayburn and Hite Island Beach. Dean had paid up to $200 for each victim he or Brooks were able to lure to his apartment. Police initially were skeptical of Henley's claims, assuming the sole homicide of the case was that of Dean, which they had ascribed to being the result of drug-fueled fisticuffs and that had turned deadly. Henley was quite insistent, however, and upon his recalling the names of 3 boys, Cobble, Hilligest, and Jones, whom he stated he and David Brooks had procured for Dean, the police accepted that there was something to his claims, as all 3 teenagers were listed as missing at Houston Police Headquarters. David Hilligest had been reported missing in the summer of 1971. The other 2 boys had been missing for just 2 weeks. Moreover, the floor of the room where the 3 teenagers had been tied was covered in thick plastic sheeting. Police also found a plywood torture board measuring 8 by 3 feet, with handcuffs attached by nylon rope at its corners and nylon ropes to the other 2. Also found at Dean's address were a large hunting knife, rolls of clear plastic or of the same type used to cover the floor, a portable radio rigged to a pair of dry cells to give increased volume, an electric motor with loose wires attached, 8 pairs of handcuffs, a number of dildos, thin glass tubes, and lengths of rope. Dean's Ford Ecoline van, parked in the driveway, conveyed a similar impression. The rear windows of the van were sealed by opaque blue curtains. In the rear of the vehicle, police found a coil of rope, a swatch of beige rug covered in soil stains, and a wooden crate with air holes drilled in the sides. The pegboard walls inside the rear of the van were rigged with several rings and hooks. Another wooden crate with air holes drilled in the sides was found in Dean's backyard. Inside this crate were several strands of human hair. Henley agreed to accompany police to Dean's boat shed in southwest Houston, where he claimed the bodies of most of the victims could be found. Inside Dean's boat shed, police found a half-stripped car, which turned out to have been stolen from a used car lot in March, a child's bike, a large iron drum, water containers, two sacks of lime, and a large plastic bag full of teenage boys' clothes. Two prison trustees began digging through the soft, shell-crusted earth of the boat shed and soon uncovered the body of a young, blonde-haired teenage boy lying on his side, encased in plastic and buried beneath a layer of lime. Police continued excavating through the earth of the shed, unearthing the remains of more victims in varying stages of decomposition. Most of the bodies found were wrapped in thick, clear plastic sheeting. Some victims had been shot, others strangled, and the ligatures were still wrapped tightly around their necks. All of the victims found had been sodomized, and most victims found bore evidence of sexual torture, such as pubic hairs had been plucked out, genitals had been chewed, objects had been inserted into their rectums, and glass rods had been inserted into their urethra and smashed. Cloth rags had also been inserted into the victim's mouth and adhesive tape wound around their face to muffle their screams. The mouth of the third victim unearthed on August 8th was so agape that all upper and lower teeth were visible, leading investigators to theorize that the youth had died with a scream on his lips. On August 8th, 1973, 8 corpses were uncovered at the boat shed. Accompanied by his father, David Brooks presented himself at the Houston police station on the evening of August 8th, 1973, and gave a statement in which he denied any participation in the murders, but admitted to having known that Dean Coral had raped and killed two boys in 1970. On the morning of August 9th, 1973, Henley gave a full written statement detailing his and Brooks' involvement with Dean Coral in the abduction and murder of numerous boys. In this confession, Henley readily admitted to having personally killed approximately 9 boys and to have assisted Dean in strangulation of others. He stated the only 3 abductions and murders Brooks had not assisted him and Coral with were the 3 murders committed in the summer of 1973. That afternoon, Henley accompanied police to Lake Sam Rayburn in San Augustine County, where he, Brooks, and Dean had buried 4 victims killed that year. 2 additional bodies were found in a shallow, lime-soaked grave located close to a dirt road. Inside the lakeside log cabin owned by Dean's family, police found a second plywood torture board, rolls of plastic sheeting, shovels, and a sack of lime. Police found 9 additional bodies in the boat shed on August 9, 1973, all of which were in an advanced state of decomposition. One of the bodies unearthed bore evidence of sexual mutilation. The severed genitals of the victims were found inside a sealed plastic bag placed beside the body. Another victim unearthed had several fractured ribs. The 13th and 14th bodies unearthed bore identification cards naming the victims as Donald and Jerry Waldrop. David Brooks gave a full confession on the evening of August 9th, admitting to being present at several killings and assisting in several burials, although he continued to deny any direct participation in the murders. In reference to the torture board upon which Dean had restrained and tortured his victims, Brooks stated, "Once they were on the board, They were as good as dead. It was all over, the shouting and crying. It was all over but the shouting and crying. He agreed to accompany the police to High Island Beach to assist in the search for the bodies of the victims. On August 10th of 1973, Henley again accompanied police to Lake Sam Rayburn, where two more bodies were found buried just 10 feet apart. As with the two bodies found the previous day, both victims had been tortured and severely beaten, particularly around the head. That afternoon, both Henley and Brooks accompanied police to High Island Beach, leading police to the shallow grave of two victims. On August 13, 1973, both Henley and Brooks again accompanied the police to High Island Beach, where four more bodies were found, making a total of 27 known victims, the worst killing spree in American history at the time. Henley initially insisted that there were two more bodies to be found inside the boat shed, and that the bodies of two more boys had been buried at High Island Beach in 1972. At the time, the killing spree was the worst case of serial murder in terms of the number of victims in the United States, exceeding the 25 murders attributed to Juan Corona, who had been arrested in California in 1971 for killing 25 men. The macabre record number of known victims attributed to a single murder case set by the Houston mass murders was only surpassed in 1978 by none other than John Wayne Gacy, who murdered 33 boys and young men and who admitted to being influenced by Dean and his accomplices. Families of Dean's victims were highly critical of the Houston Police Department, which had been quick to list the missing boys as runaways who had not been considered worthy of major investigation. The families of the murdered boys asserted that the police should have noted an insidious trend in the pattern of disappearances of teenage boys from the Heights neighborhood. Other family members complained the police had been dismissive of their adamant insistence that their sons had no reason to run away from home. Everett Waldrop, the father of Donald and Jerry Waldrop, complained that shortly after his sons had disappeared in 1971, he had informed police an acquaintance had observed Dean burying what appeared to be bodies at his boat shed. In response, the police performed a perfunctory search around the shed before dismissing the report as a hoax. Waldrop stated that on one occasion when he visited the Houston Police Department, the police chief had simply told him, "Why are you down here? You know your boys are runaways." The mother of Gregory Malley Winkle stated, "You don't run away from home with nothing but a bathing suit and 80 cents. By April of 1974, 21 of Dean's victims had been identified, but with all but four of the boys having either lived in or close connection to Houston Heights. Two more teenagers were identified in 1983 and 1985, one of whom, Richard Kepner, also lived in Houston Heights. The other boy, Willard Branch, lived in Oak Forest District of Houston. On August 13th, a grand jury convened in Harris County to hear evidence against Henley and Brooks. The first witness to testify were Rhonda Williams and Tim Curley, who testified to the events of August 7th and 8th, leading to the death of Dean Corll. Another witness who testified to his experience at the hands of Dean Corll was Billy Renninger. After listening to over 6 hours of testimony from various people, on August 14th, the jury the jury initially indicted Henley on 3 murder charges and Brooks on 1 count. Bail for each boy was set at $100,000. The district attorney requested that Henley undergo a psychiatric examination to determine whether he was mentally competent to stand trial, but his attorney opposed the decision, stating the move would violate Henley's constitutional rights. By the time the grand jury had completed its investigation, Henley had been indicted for 6 murders and Brooks for 4. Henley was not charged with the death of Dean Corll, which prosecutors ruled on September 18th had been committed in self-defense. Elmer Wayne Henley and David Owen Brooks were tried separately for their roles in the murders. Henley was brought to trial in San Antonio on July 1st of 1974, charged with six murders committed between March 1972 and July 1973. The prosecution called dozens of witnesses, including Tim Curley and a young boy named Billy Redinger, who had been lured to Dean Corll's Schuler Street address by Henley, Brooks, and Dean in 1972. Redinger testified that at Dean's home, he was tied to Dean's torture board and assaulted repeatedly by Dean before he was released. Other incriminating testimony came from police officers who read from Henley's written statements. In one part of the confession, Henley had described his luring of 2 of the victims for whose murder he had been brought to trial, Charles Coble and Marty Jones, to Corll's Pasadena house. Henley had confessed that after their initial abuse and torture at Dean's home, Coble and Jones each had one wrist and ankle bound to the same side of Dean's torture board. The boys were then forced by Dean to fight each other with the promise that the youth who had beat the other to death would be allowed to live. After several hours of each boy beating the other, Jones was tied to a board and forced to watch Charles Coble again be assaulted, tortured, and shot to death before he himself was again raped, tortured, and strangled with a Venetian blind cord. These 2 boys were killed on July 27th of 1973, 2 days after they had been reported missing. Several victims' parents had to leave the courtroom to regain their composure, as police and medical examiners described how their relatives were tortured and murdered. Throughout the trial, state introduced 82 pieces of evidence, including Corll's torture board and one of the boxes used to transport the victims. Inside the box, police had found hair, which examiners had concluded came from both Charles Coble and Wayne Henley. Upon advice from his defense counsel, Henley did not take the stand to testify. His defense attorney cross-examined several witnesses, but did not call any witnesses or experts for the defense. On July 15th of 1974, both counsels presented their closing arguments to the jury. The prosecution, seeking life imprisonment. The defense, a verdict of not guilty. In his closing arguments to the jury, District Attorney Carol Vinnie apologized for his not being able to seek the death penalty, adding that the case was the most extreme example of man's inhumanity to man I have ever seen. The jury deliberated for 92 minutes before finding Henley guilty of all 6 murders for which he was tried. The following day, July 16th, formal procedure to sentence Henley for the 6 guilty verdicts began, and on August 8th, the judge ordered that Henley serve each 99-year sentence consecutively, which would total to 594 years, and he was transferred to the Huntsville unit to formally begin his sentence. Henley appealed his sentence and conviction, contending the jury in his initial trial had not been sequestered, that his attorney's objections to the news media being present in the courtroom had been overruled, and citing that the defense team's attempt to present evidence contending that the initial trial should not have been held in San Antonio and also been overruled by the judge. Henley's appeal was upheld and he was awarded a retrial in December of 1978. Henley's retrial began on July 18th of 1979. The second trial was held in Corpus Christi, with Henley again represented by the same defense attorneys. Henley's attorneys again attempted to have Henley's written statement ruled inadmissible. However, the judge ruled that the written statement given by Henley on August 9th of 1973 was admissible evidence. The retrial lasted 9 days, with Henley's attorneys again calling no defense witnesses and again attacking the credibility of Henley's written confession. The defense also contended the evidence provided by the state belonged to Dean Corll, not Elmer Wayne Henley. On June 27th of 1979, the jury deliberated for over 2 hours before reaching their verdict. Henley was again convicted of 6 murders and sentenced to 6 concurrent 99-year terms. Brooks was brought to trial on February 27th of 1975. Brooks had been indicted on 4 murders committed between December 1970 and June 1973. But was brought to trial. But was brought to trial charged only with the June 1973 murder of 15-year-old William Ray Lawrence. Brooks' defense attorney, Jim Skelton, argued that his client had not committed any murders and attempted to portray Dean, and to a lesser degree, Henley, as being the active participants in the actual killings. The assistant district attorney dismissed the defense contention outright, at one point telling the jury, "This defendant was in on the killings, this murderous rampage, from the very beginning. He tells you he was a cheerleader, if nothing else. That's what he was telling you about his presence. You know he was in on it." Brooks' trial lasted less than 1 week. The jury deliberated for just 90 minutes before they reached a verdict. He was found guilty of Lawrence's murder on March 4th, 1975, and sentenced to life imprisonment. Brooks showed no emotion at the sentence as the sentence was passed, although his wife burst into tears. Brooks also appealed his decision, contending that the signed confession used against him was taken without his being informed of his legal rights, but his appeal was dismissed in May of 1979. So both Brooks and Henley are serving life sentences. Henley is incarcerated at the Mark W. Michael Unit in Anderson County, Texas, and Brooks is incarcerated at Terrell Unit near Rosharon, Texas. So, as you could imagine, it took quite some time for them to identify all of the victims. And on the Wikipedia page, there is a listing for every victim in, you know, the active years. But, okay, so let me just go with the forensic developments in the case. So in June of 2018, Dr. Sharon Derrick, if you remember that name, I talked about her in the first bonus episode. She's a forensic anthropologist with the medical examiner's office in Houston. So anyway, in June of 2008, she released digital images of Dean's 3 still unidentified victims. So in 2018, there were still 3 boys that had not been identified. The unidentified victims were listed as ML733349, ML733356, and ML733378. Two of the unidentified victims were found buried in the boat shed and were estimated to have been killed in 1971 or 1972. ML733378 was buried at Lake Sam Rayburn, just 10 feet from the body of Homer Garcia, who had disappeared on July 7th of 1973. The victims were estimated to be in slightly more advanced state of decomposition to Garcia, leading investigators to estimate that he had been killed in the mid to late June 1973. So, on October 17th of 2008, ML733349 was identified as Randall Lee Harvey, a Heights teenager who had been reported missing on March 11th, 1971, 2 days after he had disappeared. Harvey, who had been shot through the eye, was wearing a navy blue jacket with red lining, jeans, and lace-up boots. A plastic orange pocket comb was also found alongside his body. A body found on a beach in Jefferson County in August of 1983 is strongly believed to be the 28th victim of Dean Coral. The body was identified on November 11th of 2009 through DNA analysis as 17-year-old Joseph Lyles, a Heights teenager who had disappeared on February 1st of 1973. Lyles is known to have both visited Dean's apartment and to have lived on the same street as David Brooks. He was listed as a possible victim of Dean after the other murders were discovered in 1973. At the time of his disappearance, Dean resided in an apartment at 1855 Wirt Road, where he lived between January 20th and March 7th of 1973, when he moved to his father's Pasadena bungalow. Brooks had specifically stated Dean had got one boy by himself during that time he lived at the address. In addition, at the time that Lyles disappeared, Henley had temporarily moved to Mount Pleasant, which leaves a strong possibility that Coral had killed Lyles without the assistance of Henley. So on September 13th of 2010, DNA analysis was able to confirm the unidentified victim known as ML733378 was actually Michael Anthony Bulch, who had incorrectly been identified as case file ML733333, the second victim unearthed from the boat shed. Michael Bulch had disappeared en route to a barber on July 19th of 1973, a year after his brother Billy had been murdered by Dean. The 1973 misidentification of Michael Bulch was discovered as a result of independent investigation conducted by a reporter named Barbara Gibson, who submitted her research to Dr. Derrick that indicated that the second victim unearthed from the boat shed had been misidentified. Henley had stated in his confession to the police that he and Dean had choked Michael Bulch and buried him in Lake Sam Rayburn. The unidentified victim, mistakenly identified as Michael Belch, had been killed by two gunshots in the head and buried beneath the boat shed. Three factors had helped lead to the 1973 misidentification of Michael Belch. Michael's parents had previously filed a missing persons report on their son in August of 1972, precisely the same time as the second victim unearthed from the boat shed was estimated to have been killed. This was the only missing persons report on file for Michael Bulch. In addition, the victim was of a similar height to Bulch, and circumstantial dental fractures had also helped facilitate the misidentification. I mean, I could keep going through this forensic development stuff, but I guess all you really need to know at this point is that all of the bodies of the victims that were found have been identified with the exception of one. So, but before we get to that one unidentified victim, 42 boys had vanished the Houston area since 1970. The police were heavily criticized for curtailing the search for further victims once the record of Juan Corona for having the most victims had been surpassed. After finding the 26th and 27th bodies tied together at Hite Island Beach on August 13th, the search for any further victims was terminated, despite Henley's insistence that two further bodies had been buried on the beach in 1972. A curious feature about this final discovery was the presence of two extra bones, an arm bone and a pelvis, in the grave, indicating at least one additional uncovered victim. The two bodies that Henley had insisted were still buried on the beach may have been those of Mark Scott and Joseph Lyles. In light of the developments relating to the identification of the victims, the bodies of Scott still lies undiscovered in High Island, while Lyles' remains were only found by chance in 1983. Had the search for the bodies continued, both victims would have likely been discovered. Following Hurricane Ike in 2008, the area of High Island Beach, where Dean is known to have buried his victims, remained submerged, leaving a strong possibility that Scott's body will never be found. So I told you that there's one unidentified victim, but apparently there's also one unfound victim that Henley knows is dead as a result of Dean Coral, but they haven't recovered him. And basically, what this is saying is that they didn't search for him anymore after a certain point. So former workers at the Coral Candy Company recalled Coral doing a lot of digging in the years leading up to 1968, when his mother's third marriage was deteriorating and the firm was failing. Coral stated he was burying spoiled candy to avoid contamination by insects. He subsequently cemented over the floor. He was also observed digging in waste ground that was later converted into a car park. Former Coral Candy Company employees also recalled that Coral had rolls of clear plastic of precisely the same type used to bury his victims. Moreover, co-workers at the Houston Lighting and Power Company would also state that from the earliest days of his employment, Coral had repeatedly retained coils of used nylon cord that would otherwise have been discarded. This brand of cord was the same type used to strangle and bind the bodies of many of his victims. The suspicion is that Coral may have begun killing much earlier than 1970 and may have been abusing boys prior to this date. And I say that's not far-fetched. Moreover, Brooks claimed that Dean's first murder victim was a boy killed at an apartment complex on Judy Way Street where Dean had lived prior to September 1970. The earliest of Dean's victims known by Brooks were two teenage boys killed at 3030 Yorktown. I'm sorry, 3300 Yorktown, where Dean lived after moving out of his Judy Way Street apartment. Dean's earliest double murder was that of James Glass and Danny Yates that took place in December of 1970. Glass and Yates were actually killed at Dean's Yorktown address, as was Dean's earliest known murder victim, Jeffrey Allen Conan, killed in September of 1970. A possibility exists that the earliest double murder victims were Glass and Yates. However, Brooks specifically described Glass as being killed in an altogether separate double murder from Dean's first double murder in his confession to police. In addition, Brooks only knew the location of Conan's body in High Island Beach due to the fact that Dean had shown him the location. It is possible that the initial double murder Brooks had discovered Dean in the process of committing occurred after the murder of Conan and before those of Glass and Yates. These details, alongside the two additional bones that were found with the 26th and 27th victim, were victim discovered, indicated a minimum of two and possibly four more unknown victims. There are two suspiciously long gaps between known victims in the chronology of Dean's known murders. Dean's last known victim of 1971 was Reuben Watson Haney, who disappeared on August 17th. The first victim of 1972 was Willard Branch Jr., who disappeared on February 9th, meaning no known victims were killed for almost 6 months. Moreover, Dean also is not known to have killed between February 1st and June 4th of 1973. Dean's only known unidentified victim, the 16th boy found in the boat shed, was in an advanced stage of decomposition at the time of discovery, leading investigators to deduce that the victim had likely been killed in 1971 or 1972. So here we go. This is this remaining unidentified victim, and now we're going to tell you about him. The unidentified victim was found wearing swimming trunks, cowboy boots, a leather bracelet, and a t-shirt, leading investigators to conclude that he was likely killed in the summer months. The body was found buried near the entrance of the boat shed between the bodies of Reuben Haney and Stephen Sickman, whereas the bodies of the victims killed between December 1970 and May 1971 were found buried at the rear of the shed. It is likely, though not conclusive, that the unidentified 16th victim found within the boat shed may have been killed in the late summer or early fall of 1971. Dr. Sharon Derrick has stated that she believes this particular victim may be named Herman, Harmon, or French, due to the fact that the only outstanding missing persons report related to boys, to a young boy from the Houston area dated between 1970 and 1973, which fits the forensic profile of this unknown boy, holds these surnames. In addition, the t-shirt this boy had worn bore a handwritten inscription believed to read either LB4MF, LBHMF, or L84MF. Regardless of the dates when the unidentified boat shed victim had been killed, there still remains a gap of 4 months between February and June 1973, when no known victims had been claimed by Dean. In March of 1973, a Mr. and Mrs. Abernathy had reported to Galveston County authorities that they had observed three men carrying and bearing a long wrapped bundle at Galveston Beach. The couple identified two of the men as Coral and Henley. The third individual had long hair like Brooks. As the couple watched the trio, one of the men, whom she later identified as Henley, advanced upon their car with a menacing expression so much so that the couple felt compelled to drive away. Two women had also observed three men digging at the beach in May of 1973, one of whom they had positively identified as Brooks. However, police were again unwilling to extend the search. In February 2012, a picture was released to the news media of a likely unknown victim of Dean. The color Polaroid image has been found in the personal possessions of Henley, which had been stored by his family since his arrest in 1973. The image depicts a blonde-haired teenage boy in handcuffs, strapping to an undepicted device upon Dean's floor. Alongside a toolbox known to contain various instruments Dean is known to have used to torture his victims. The individual depicted had been ruled out by the Harris County Medical Examiner's Office as being any of Coral's known victims, including his one remaining unidentified victim. Henley himself had stated that the picture must have been taken after he had acquired a Polaroid camera in 1972, although he is adamant that he had no idea who this boy is. Given that Henley became an acquaintance of Coral in 1972, it is likely that this boy would have been killed in 1972 or 1973. Okay, now there is a potential for an association with a national sex ring, and I'm just going to go over that real quick. So during a routine investigation in March of 1975, the Houston police discovered a cache of pornographic pictures and films depicting young boys. Of the 16 individuals depicted within the films and photos, 11 of the youth appeared to be among the 21 victims of Dean Coral who had been identified by this date. The discovery raised the disturbing possibility that the statements Coral had given to both Henley and Brooks prior to his murder had associated with an organization based in Dallas that bought and sold boys may have indeed held a degree of truth. The discovery of this material in Houston in 1975 subsequently led to the arrest of 5 individuals in Santa Clara, California. No direct link in these arrests to Coral was proven, as Houston police declined to pursue any possible links to the killings, stating they felt Coral's victims' families had suffered enough. There is still no conclusive evidence to suggest that Coral had ever solicited any of his victims in this manner, not only because Houston police chose not to pursue this potential possibility, but also because neither Brooks nor Henley have ever mentioned meeting any individuals from the organization Coral had claimed to be involved with. In addition to these facts, they also had never mentioned ever having seen the victims either filmed, photographed, or released from Coral's torture board until after their torture and murder. The arrests in Santa Clara do, however, indicate a possible validity into Brooks' statement to police that Coral had informed him that the earliest murdered victims had been buried in California. So that's the first. Now, I done been through all of this with y'all, and that is the first time that I heard of any victims being buried in California. But so they're saying there's 28 victims, but really there could be a whole lot more, and it could be connected to a sex ring. It just seems like it goes deeper, but really the saddest part is that the Houston Police Department apparently didn't have any interest in investigating these young boys' disappearances, which I see a lot when I'm doing research for these cases. I think a lot of times when the police get these reports of disappearances, they just automatically assume that people run away. And that's not always the case, unfortunately, as in this situation. But let me tell you about, because we're almost coming up to the 2-hour mark now. I know I've been rambling forever, but it's a really long story. Let me tell you about the unidentified male real quick. So in the DOE network, he is 1010UMTX, and in NamUs, he is UP4547. He was between 5'2" and 5'7". He's Caucasian or Hispanic, between 15 and 20 years old. He had brown hair that was 7 inches long, unknown eye color. He had a mild form of spina bifida, which may have caused him lower back pain or possibly affected his stride. However, it may not have produced any noticeable symptoms. He also had chronic irritation of sternal end of clavicle. I'm not quite sure what that means. So his clothing, brown leather cowboy boots that were 12 inches in length and had the words Neolite on the heel. Multicolored swim trunks with a belt that had gold colored wings and the letter C on the silver buckle, a khaki long sleeve t-shirt that tied in front and had a large peace symbol and the letters USMC and L84MF on the back. The dark blue corduroy and dark blue corduroy size 3240. Okay, so when I release this episode, or when this episode comes out on Sunday, I will post the pictures of the clothing and his reconstruction by LSU Faces. Shout out to LSU Faces. They always do a really good job. But they have his clothes and his reconstruction on the Doe Network. So I'll post that for you on the Facebook page. And I will say that if you believe that you know who this is, I know that this was a long time ago, but if you know who this unidentified victim of Dean Corll is, you can go ahead and contact Dr. Sharon Derrick over at the Harris County Institute of Forensic Sciences, because as hard as she works, and obviously she works really hard, she does a good job, because we've come across her a few times. This is the one that she still hasn't figured out yet, and I think that this young boy or young man deserves to have a name and not just a victim of Dean Corll. Everybody else in this situation has been identified except for him. So I really hope that at some point he becomes identified so that his family, who may not even be aware that he is missing, can have some kind of proper burial for him. So, with all that being said, in almost a 2-hour episode, a bonus episode at that, we are done for this episode. I think this is the longest episode that I've ever recorded and published to you. But I hope that you enjoyed it, and I hope it was a good one. So, with that being said, I hope that this story made your day, and I hope that you return for the next regular episode where I tell you more about those never to be seen again.